The Bermuda Triangle. Well, of course, the riddle makes sense now.
Often the way with riddles, Mum.
That geek cliché chap is very clever.
Indeed, Mum. Ah, I can see a boat on the horizon. It appears to have an unnecessarily large engine and garish flames painted on the side.
Oh, the kind compensating for a tiny...
ego. Exactly, Mum.
Oh, could you send him a message by semaphore? I really don't want to speak to him, even though we've solved his stupid riddle.
Very good, Mum. And what would you like the message to say?
Something triumphant and very scathing. I'll hold the binoculars.
I have just the thing, Mum.
Oh, yes, he's watching through a telescope. Oh, he doesn't look very happy. Oh, my goodness, well, there was really no call for that. How rude. I don't know what you said to him, Latimer, but he's leaving very quickly.
No more or less than the truth, Mum.
Good. Well, I'm sure that's the last we'll hear from him. Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't spent too much time admiring the cast lineup for the Black Panther movie. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Well, we're continuing our very pleasant voyage on the luxury yacht, the Vanessa. Latimer still hasn't told me who he has borrowed it from. All I've been able to piece together is that he's very interested in New York property and is someone that one really shouldn't upset. That being said, if you could make sure you take extra special care not to scratch the deck with your chairs, that would be splendid.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but your guest has arrived, a Ms. Kate Elliott.
Splendid. Let's see her calling card. Kate Elliott, writer, I Make Up Worlds.
Ah, now we know who to blame.
No, not this world, Latimer, other worlds.
Oh.
Show her over then, Latimer.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Kate Elliott is a fantasy and science fiction author whose most recent novels include the epic fantasy Black Wolves and the first in a new YA series called Court of Fives.
Ms. Kate Elliott, Mum.
Hello, Kate. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Oh, it really is my pleasure. And we have the weather again. We're being so blessed with fine weather on this voyage.
I'm so delighted to hear it because, as you know, I live in Hawaii and it's become tremendously difficult for me to endure anything below about 80 degrees or 75 degrees. That would be Fahrenheit. I know that you British people use a different system. So let's say below 20 centigrade. And so I thank you very much for arranging this gorgeous weather for me today.
Well, we do try our best. Would you care for some tea?
I would.
And how do you take your tea?
Well, I love English breakfast tea, and I learned to drink tea when I was on a junior year abroad program in the United Kingdom, in Wales, as it happens, which is where I learned that you have to have milk with your tea.
Oh, well, yes, though I'm not so strict as to impose that on people, but I do secretly judge people if they only want lemon, and I try not to. But yes, I agree. Milk with English breakfast tea is the way forwards. I'm so delighted because that's what's in the teapot. So I'll pour. And a dash of milk, I take it?
No, a little more than that.
Oh, marvellous.
More than a dash of milk.
And would you care for some upside-down banana cake with maple caramel sauce?
I'm sorry, I'm so overcome that I can't speak. Yes, please.
This is just the most amazing cake. This is the first time Latimer, the butler, has baked it, so I'm very excited to try it. So I'll cut you a slicer. Don't mind the chickens over there. They won't interfere with us in the pen. I've put them in a pen so they don't flap off overboard by accident. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
I'm not, and in fact, I grew up in the country, so chickens and I have a long relationship.
Marvellous. So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio. What have you decided to bring with you today?
Well, I love the ocean, and I'm always a little concerned, though, that we know that anything could happen, you know, that the boat could spring a leak. And so I have brought my paddle, no euphemisms here. I have brought my outrigger canoe paddle with me.
Oh, marvelous.
I actually have only brought one of them with me. I have four, because that's what you do when you paddle outrigger canoes in Hawaii. You keep buying new ones. But this one I have here is a monoblade made by a man on the leeward side of Hawaii to order for me. He brought it to a parking lot, and I brought the cash, and we exchanged it like it was a drug deal. It reaches to my armpit, the correct size. It's made of a very light wood, has a little bit of a green trim, and five turtle stencils on the back, which is two large ones and three small ones, which represents my family.
Oh, that's lovely.
And it's the paddle I use when I paddle outrigger canoes on the ocean. And so just in case we can escape. If there's any problems later, we'll have a way to escape. We just need a boat and a canoe or some kind of small craft, and we have the paddle.
I'm very, very pleased, because I must admit, I am a tad nervous sailing into the Bermuda Triangle. It just seems to be asking for trouble, but hopefully we'll be okay.
I hope so.
Yeah. So for those of us who aren't particularly familiar with outrigger canoes, how could you describe them to us?
The outrigger canoe, and please stop me when I start going on for an hour because I love all this stuff. The outrigger canoe is a invention specific to the Pacific and the Pacific Islands. It's a canoe made often, canoes are generally in the early days made from large logs, from large trees. But the thing about the outrigger is that it has a float off to generally to the left, sometimes to both sides, that's attached to it usually by wood or maybe by something else. And it's a almost perfect invention for people who lived in open ocean conditions. So they lived in an island in the middle of a large ocean where you have a lot of wave action and surf. So if you're coming in and out of an atoll, or if you're trying to paddle, say, around the edge from on Oahu, if you're trying to paddle down the coast a little bit, you're going to be dealing with a lot of wave action. And that float that sits off to one side of the canoe gives you an added amount of stability without slowing down your canoe too much. And it also means, so for example, you know, if a wave comes up, the float gives you that the float will come up, but your main canoe, rather than tipping over, will be able to absorb that wave action.
One of our listeners, Hisham, has asked how you got into racing these outrigger canoes, because you participate in racing them, I understand.
I do. Many people associate Hawaii with surfing, for good reason, because surfing was invented here. But what people don't know is that the state sport, the official state sport of Hawaii, is outrigger canoe racing. And that is for many reasons, but the two I'll discuss is, first of all, Native Hawaiians got to this island chain, which is the most isolated place on Earth, in terms of the most isolated places where inhabited place on Earth. We are so far from anywhere else. They got here by double-hulled outrigger canoe. 1,000-1,500 years ago. So that's the first reason that it's the official state sport. And the other one is that Hawaii is a culture of inclusion and working together, with the part of the whole idea of aloha is working together. So because it's a team sport, I think that it's more favored as the official state sport than surfing, which is an individual activity. And it's not, I mean, people here surf, everybody here surfs, right? But as a sport, outrigger canoe racing is... it's something that is considered.
So it's kind of in line with the spirit of the place.
Thank you. Yes. And so it was easy enough for me to get involved. Actually, when we moved here, I was forced to move to Hawaii. I know you're all crying now. forced to move to Hawaii because my husband got a job here. And within a month of moving here, I had seen newspaper articles about this outrigger canoe paddling and these races, both sprint races and long distance races. And I said to my husband, oh, could you ask at your work, you know, if anybody knows about this? I knew immediately that I wanted to do it. I'm Danish American, probably ancient, my ancient history, there's probably Viking. So I love the water. I love the water and the ocean. But at that time, he was traveling a lot for his work, and our kids were still in middle school and high school when we first moved here. So I really didn't get to it until the kids were out of school, because I didn't really have time. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the youngest graduated from high school, I ran into a friend of mine who said, oh, I just finished doing this, you know, the season. Do you want to come to the winter season, which is when they bring in new paddlers? And I haven't looked back. I mean, literally, I got in the canoe the first day and I got out of the canoe, and the next day I hurt all over my body. Oh. It activates muscles you never knew you had. And that was it. I've never wanted to stop since then. It's kind of an obsession. And for people who do this, who race, and I'm not even in the top level, it's an obsession. So yeah, I love it. But I love being out on the ocean so much. The ocean is to me the most amazing place. And I can't describe it. It's just a place where you are so insignificant. The ocean will be there for a long time. It's so much bigger than we are. And I love that sense.
My family has a long history of serving in the Royal Navy, and I've grew up near the coast, and so I know exactly what you mean. It's something that is very deep in the soul. If you become attached to the sea, it never goes away.
Yes.
It's an incredible thing. I must send you a link to a song. I hope I'll be able to find it online, which is by my favorite band called Elbow. And it's the last song on their current album. And it's about two refugees in a boat on the ocean. And it conveys so perfectly the sense of terror and majesty and humility of traveling as vulnerable people on the ocean, and how the ocean supports you and also can kill you at any moment, and what that's like. I'm going to have to send it to you.
That's exactly what it is. That the ocean is majestic, and you are part of it. And yet you also know that you could die in a moment. Would it matter? I mean, it would to you and to the people who care about you, but in the ocean, you're just nothing. You're just another tiny speck on this huge, vast place.
Now, another one of our lovely listeners, Paul, has asked if you could race anywhere in the world, all expenses paid, anywhere in the world, where would you choose to race?
There are actually races all over the world. And the one I would like to go to is in, I think, the Solomon Islands. They have a week worth of races, and One involves going all the way around an island, and there's also races in Tahiti. So I would like to go to the South Pacific and race there.
I wonder as well, being in a canoe, I guess you feel very intimately all of the differences wherever you race. There is very little between you and the water, I imagine, and the instant feedback must be really interesting.
It is. It's quite interesting because I don't steer, but people who steer, and especially people who are really good, really knowledgeable steersmen and women, they really understand and feel the ocean. They are listening to, and maybe it's with their feet through the canoe. Maybe it's with the sense of how the canoe is pulling against their steering blade. You're dealing with so many different factors. You've got the current and how the current is going. You've got the wind. You've got the swell action. And all of those things are acting together. And they're different in every different place you are. And then they change in the same places from day to day and week to week. Just last week, we went and paddled on the North Shore. When the first canoe club I belonged to, I paddled out of the North Shore of the island of Oahu. So for 5 years, I would go out and paddle this one strip from Haleiwa down towards Waimea Bay. And it's beautiful to be out off the island and to look towards the island and then have the ocean on the other side. It's gorgeous. Then I changed canoe clubs and I've been paddling in a different part of the island since then. But we went back and we paddled out there. And as we went out, the familiarity of the different types of water, and it's hard to explain if you're not on it. It's like as you come out past the point, the water is one way, and then you come around and then you reach a surf break. It's not really a surf break because nobody surfs there, a place called Himalayas, because the way the ground is makes the swells get really large there. And then you get past that and then the water changes again. And yet being on there, I hadn't been out there for like 3 or 4 years, and immediately I felt the familiarity of it, of having been there. So yeah. It's like meeting a person again that you haven't seen for a while. And you know that there's a few, you know, you haven't seen them for a while, but you know who they are.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice. So I live in England, which is an incredibly stable, geologically speaking, and pretty much in other ways as well, but mostly geologically stable place. I mean, if we have an earthquake, which is like 3 or 4 on the Richter scale, it's national news. Whereas you obviously live in a very active volcanic archipelago, and you know there's often lava there, which is not, I must admit, top on my list of things I'd like to have where I live. What's it like living somewhere which is so geologically active?
Well, you know, there are two different kinds of volcanoes. I'm sure there's more than two different kinds, but there's two main different kinds. One are the correct terms, but the one is the pyroclastic volcano like Mount St. Helens in Oregon, which blew its top. And volcanoes like that, the pressure builds up and up and up, and then it blows. And so Vesuvius is like that. The one Krakatoa is like that. But Hawaii is basically a moving hot spot, and it's a shield volcano, which means the lava just kind of like glurps out of the ground. It kind of oozes out of the ground during an active eruption, which is all the time, basically right now. You can outwalk the lava.
Oh, wow.
So you can go today, right, and drive out Chain of Craters Road or whatever it's called, and find where the lava is oozing down toward the sea. And, you know, some weeks there's lava flow that you can get up to within, you know, 20 feet of, and other weeks it's maybe not coming down, or it's in a place that's inaccessible. If the lava is coming down towards the housing project, and this has happened on the Big Island, people can pick up all their stuff and move out with days, weeks to spare.
Wow.
There's not that sense of like in the Caribbean where you're like, oh my God, it could happen at any moment. And then we would, you know, have to escape, and we would have an hour to escape.
Yeah. And that's the thing, because obviously the only kind of consumption of volcanoes I've had are through really, really rubbish, but also brilliant Hollywood movies. And so the prospect of lava and being anywhere near lava is instantly terrifying. But the idea of being able to outwalk it just makes all of that seem so laughable.
Right. And so currently the only geologically active island is the Big Island, Hawaii, which we call the Big Island here because it's bigger than the other islands. Get it? So Oahu was somewhat down the chain. So the one before the Big Island was Maui, and Maui is now kind of split into, I believe geologically, split into three islands. So Maui used to be this like super big island, and the Mount Haleakala is still a significant mountain. Whereas on Oahu, we don't have a significant mountain anymore because it has eroded. Underwater, you can see the remains of these avalanches where the mountain eroded. And Oahu is, I don't know how many millions of years old. And if you have ever read anything about World War 2 and Midway Atoll, which was midway across the Pacific. And so they have an airfield there. And that was where people would stop, especially it became famous during World War II because it was where it was an important American airbase, because you would stop there and refuel mm-hmm. halfway across the Pacific. Midway Atoll is like this island that's barely above water, surrounded by coral reefs and atolls. And it used to be the hot spot. The Hawaiian island chain is much larger than the seven islands that we see on the map today. It goes several thousand miles onward. And this is this long chain where they've all been part of the hot spot, which has built up these islands and mountains and then moved on. Mm-hmm. In fact, there is off the coast of Hawaii, of the Big Island, there is a new place starting. A new island is starting to be built underwater. And it's going to come, I don't know how long, in another couple decades, 100 centuries, it's going to come up and you're going to see the formation of the next island.
Oh, that's so exciting.
It is. So you can see the geologic history of this hotspot across these thousands of miles in the Pacific Ocean. And some people say that it is the presence of this hotspot that makes Hawaii the kind of the special, unique place it is. I don't, I can't answer that, but there is something about this place that feels unique, and maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, maybe so. But I find that so fascinating because, as I say, I live somewhere so stable. So obviously we have coastal erosion and things just kind of fall away at the edges. And Britain is tilting slightly. So I think Cornwall raises up by a centimetre a year. And that is it. That is the extent of the excitement. So the fact that you've got an island that's soon to appear is just the most thrilling idea to me. It's wonderful. I love it.
Well, that's soon in geologic time. Maybe that's one of the unique things about Hawaii, which is, on the one hand, because it's a shield volcano, it is in a way the most stable kind of volcano you can have, which means that there's no immediate threat of catastrophic momentary change that can alter everything. But at the same time, there's constant change going on here in a very slow way. So it's an interesting balance between those two.
Yeah, that sounds kind of perfect, in fact. So you've had many books published and they've spanned several series. And I may be wrong, and please do tell me if I'm wrong, but I have a suspicion that you, like all authors, sometimes feel doubts, perhaps in your writing or your career. And I was wondering, when you do feel these doubts, how do you cope with them?
You know, I often wonder if there are people, if there are writers and artists out there who don't feel doubt, and if they don't, what does that mean? Because I can't imagine it. It is like a constant part of the process.
And, yep.
And in a way, on the one hand, I fight against it constantly, thinking like, if only I wouldn't doubt myself, if only I wouldn't hate what I'm doing and think that I have, lost my ability. You know that point in the book where I say, honey, to my spouse, I say, honey, oh my gosh, you know what? I thought this book was good when I started, but now realize it's the worst thing I've ever written and I can't make it work. And then he looks at me and he says, that's what you said about the last book. And then yep. say, but honey, this time is different.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And how before you start every book, there's that moment where you go, oh shit, I've forgotten how to write books. It's all gone. There's nothing there at all. Yeah, it's horrible. How do you deal with that then?
I just wrote a first draft. I'm revising it now, in which I wrote the whole first draft in a state of complete self-loathing. And I don't say that lightly. And I did it because it was on deadline and I knew I had to do it. And I did it by just pushing through. Mm. I think when I was a new writer, I had fewer extreme doubts because I didn't know how hard the business was. I didn't know. I was just more naive then. And I think a lot of knowledge in this case is helpful in the sense that you can recognize the patterns, but not helpful in that you know how much you're struggling. And it just, because it is a hard business. It's you know, it's not gravy to do it. I mean, I love writing and I feel grateful every day that I get to make up these stories and that people read them and like them. But it's harder now because I know how much there is to lose and I know how much I still have to learn. So sometimes I just like, you know, put my head down and hammer my way through it, knowing that I get to revise.
Yes.
And then when I get to the revision phase, I actually find lots of stuff that's just fine.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. Every time I'm like, whoa, this scene's actually kind of good. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think also learning how the fact that you may feel something about your writing in a particular moment or week or month or whatever phase of a draft, and knowing that that is just a feeling and is not objectively correct in any sense, is also something I cling to, that it doesn't actually have any impact on what I'm writing. I can feel really happy about something or feel really awful about something I've written, and it doesn't actually change how I will feel about what I've written several months down the line. I don't know if you find the same.
I do, and I think that's an important point, because the place we're in at the moment, this is going to sound a little hokey, but I don't care, that, you know, we are always living in the present moment, like people say that we're supposed to always remember that. But so often, I think for people with anxiety, we're living in the anticipatory future and we're afraid. I'm afraid, right? I'll be writing and I'll think, what's someone going to say about this? What if this book doesn't get any reviews? What if it doesn't sell? What if this is the last book I can ever publish? And it's usually that, not the story that I'm writing, that is getting in my way. That sense of vulnerability, that sense of fear, that sense of anticipation, rather than finding. And so one of the things that I work on is to try to identify, what am I really afraid of? And it's usually not the story that I'm writing. It's usually the reactions that people have. I always set myself a challenge with every book. And so I'll say, well, what if I get this wrong? What if it doesn't come across? What if people don't like it or are offended by what I'm trying to do? It's that over and over and over again. It's that anticipation of something I can't control.
Yes. Yes. And that isn't actually real yet, or may never even be real ever.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's something that I've been trying to work really hard on, when I get lost in a worry about something and stopping myself and saying, is this actually a real thing that you can see and objectively measure, that you can hear, that you can touch, that you have some kind of empirical evidence for? Or is this all just in your head? Oh my God, no, it's all in my head. And I've just wasted a day really being really stressed about it. And yet, when you're lost in it, it's so real, isn't it?
It's amazing. I have, like you, I have been working really hard on this recently, because in some ways for me, it's gotten worse. And I'm not sure why. It just may be because of, you know, how my life is at the moment. And it's that constant pulling back to saying, what is my relationship with the text at this moment without regard for anything else? I think there's also the sense of just accepting that maybe this is always going to be how I interact with writing.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, I have to excise it from myself, to say, you know what, I have to accept it and embrace it and be kind to it, and to say, listen, I hear you. I hear that you're scared. I hear that you're vulnerable, and it's okay. And now, could you come sit on this? Now I have this nice table on this yacht. Sit here and have your upside down banana cake, right?
Yeah, because it is only trying to protect us after all.
Well, and that's a nice way to look at it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I try to remember, is that it's trying to protect us from these things that we fear. So it, in a really screwed up way, is trying to kind of barricade us in the house to protect us from the scary people outside. And you know, obviously being stuck in the house is not the best way to cope with that. And it's almost like that with the writing, that it's kind of saying, look, if you don't write this, then you don't have to expose yourself to the possibility that people will hate it or ridicule you or not buy it or whatever nebulous fears are there at the time. And acknowledging and saying, thank you for trying to protect me from those very real fears, but actually I still really want to write. Because there's that weird duality, isn't there? Like you've said about loving writing. I love writing too. And we can experience this passionate love for what we do and this screaming terror at the same time.
It's amazing because it is like, I don't know, I guess, a sine wave in which you have this height, this mountain of almost like joy and ecstasy when the writing is going well. And then this abyss, which is, you know, dank and dark and you can't see anything and there's slugs and, you know, and centipedes and sorry, I've been bitten or stung by a centipede. So, but yeah. And then mostly you're kind of on that up and down slope between them, but why? How do those two things fit? And maybe we need them both. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think I said to my husband not long ago that I am actually also scared of the day I don't feel scared anymore, because is that just total complacency? Is that where I no longer push myself? Is that where I no longer check and challenge what I've done? You know, you said, you know, are those people out there that don't feel this kind of doubt? And there's a bit of me that wonders whether that is something which keeps us on our toes almost and stops us from just lying back and going, hey, everything's wonderful and they'll buy this, it's fine. And, you know, we'd end up putting out really rubbish stuff.
You know, I think exactly the same thing. And then I think maybe it's true. And then I think maybe it's just my rationalization, but I guess it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Because it is a part of us. And we live with these things every day. We live with our imperfections every day and kind of manage to move forward. And those just kind of like well up, right? Because we're writing and because we invest. I don't know. I mean, I invest. I don't want to say we. Because I invest so much of myself into my work.
Yeah.
And it is scary to put it out there. It is vulnerable to put it out there.
Yes.
Every time it happens, even after, you know, my next published book will be Poison Blade, the second young adult novel coming in August. And that's my 26th novel. Wow. And it isn't easier for me.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I used to think maybe it would be, but it isn't. And I don't say that I don't say that to say to people, stop now. but just that it's just, it is what it is.
Hey ho.
Yeah.
So moving away from deep important things like this, I'd like you to imagine that a Hollywood executive drives a dump truck full of money to your front door and says, Kate, we need you to write a buddy cop movie. And if you accepted that dump truck full of money, I would like to know, what is the unlikely pairing that you would choose to feature as your two lead characters?
Oh, I would absolutely accept the dump truck of money. I don't have the luxury of refusing it since I'm not wealthy. The unlikely pairing, well, first of all, one of the characters would be a woman over 50.
Woohoo!
And you know, Hollywood loves their women over 50.
So much.
So much. And the other, because I live in Hawaii, the other would be, I think, another woman. You know, they love to put women together to talk about and be buddies. The other would be another woman. And one of the women would be Asia or Pacific Islander, because we don't see that many such women. And the other woman might be another woman of color. She might be white. She might be, I don't know, you know, but I think I would love to have a woman over 50 and then a woman who's like a generation younger than her. So you could get that dynamic. It could be the mother-daughter dynamic. It could be the auntie-niece dynamic. That would be my odd couple.
I would watch the hell out of that. You need to write that. I don't have the dump truck of money, unfortunately.
Actually, what I would really like to do I've had this idea for a while now, but I don't have a plot to go with it. I want to write a story, a superhero story. I love superheroes. It's like my secret love. I love superheroes. I want to write a superhero story about the women who have been eased out of their superhero groups because they're getting older and they don't look so hot in the spandex anymore.
Oh, that would be so great.
And how they end up being, so they've been like, they're like the auxiliary member now because they brought in some, you know, the hot young chick, right? The old guys, they still get to do it,
yep.
Right? Because they're like venerable now, right? And then they bring in new people, but the women who are like in the front of the show for the thing are always the young women. And to the young women who look great because you're young, I say own it, man. I looked great when I was young. And you know what? It's a great thing. Youth is a wonderful thing. Cherish it while you have it. I say, man. But I would love to write that story, and then how this woman hooks up with a couple of other women who've also been eased out, you know, maybe one from a villain crew and one from, you know, another crew or whatever, and then how they end up having to be the ones who solve the problem. That's what I would like to write.
Yeah, that sounds a lot of fun. And having female characters who are not in competition with each other.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, that would be refreshing. Yeah.
Well, their story isn't about how they support the male story.
Yes. Oh, God, yes. At some point in my future, I want to be at a convention with you and drink late into the night and talk about these things at length. Absolutely. That would be awesome.
Absolutely.
What I like to do before I have a friend over for tea is ask on the Twitters if anyone has a question that they would like to ask if they were lucky enough to be taking tea with you. And a friend, an old friend of mine called Dom, said, "I've heard a rumour that Kate Elliott is good with a sword in real life. He'd like to know if this helps or hinders writing fight scenes."
I did used to fight in the Society for Creative Anachronism. So that's for those who don't know, and I don't know that there'd be anyone listening to this podcast who wouldn't know. It's an association of people who founded in the United States in the 60s, I think, where they kind of, it's quote unquote, recreate the Middle Ages only with better plumbing and or whatever. Not that. Which is actually a bit of a misnomer because, you know, Charlemagne used to have council meetings in the Roman baths of, you know, wherever he was hanging out. But so I got involved in that right out of college, but I was never interested in the arts and crafts side of it. There were people who, you know, make beautiful costumers, amazing costumers, calligraphers, people doing craft work and stuff. I just wanted to be a stick jock and hit people over the head. So I have done that, and I have fought in wars and battles. I mean, if you consider those wars and battles, given that you're basically just using rattan sticks instead of actual edge steel, right? Mm-hmm. And that you fall over and pretend to be dead rather than actually get wounds that would fester and kill you in horrible pain after, you know, some weeks. I did get my arm broken because I didn't armor properly, but that was on me. You know, young, stupid, indestructible. And I actually met my husband in a sword fight.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So I would say that when I wrote Crown of Stars especially, it did help. Because I would use experiences I had, you know, the feeling of being crowded in among other people, or, you know, the way the sun was or dust kicked up by people walking, or the sounds, or the way people shout to each other, you know, when they're moving around or whatever. And I did incorporate those things into the battle scenes in Crown of Stars, especially because it was because it's set in a kind of an alternate medieval Europe fantasy setting. So the kind of fighting that went on there would have pretty much matched what was done in the SCA. So I think it was valuable to me. I don't do it now.
You're too busy racing.
Well, let me assure you that physically I really doubt I could, you know, I'm old, man. I couldn't take the beating and battering anymore. You know, you're wearing like anywhere from 30 to 50 pounds of armor. And I remember in this one war in the desert, and we were going to be the flanking group, and the guy who was leading us, we trotting like a mile or 2 miles through this desert scrub to try to get around the ling. And, you know, thank goodness I was in my 20s when I did that. I'd be like the one they're carrying off on the stretcher now, man.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun, actually.
It was great. Are you kidding me? It was great. I loved it. But I'm that kind of person, so.
I would just be worried about heat exhaustion. I love swords. I've always loved swords. But the desert part of it, not so sure about that side of it.
Well, I didn't go back to that particular war, which they held every year, because I didn't really enjoy the desert part of it either. But when you're in the middle of it, that's the thing. See, here's actually something really interesting about writing versus competing in like a race. When you're in a race, you have to be in the race. So you're in the moment. You're in the present moment. And I love that, because when I'm writing, I'm always in the past and in the future as well as in the present moment. And that's what causes a lot of the anxiety. Mm. I don't have anxiety. I can be out in the ocean in really challenging conditions where maybe the waves are higher, the troughs, you know, when you go down in the trough of the wave, you can't see the escort boat when you're doing a long distance race or whatever. And I don't get scared then, because I'm right there in the moment. I'm like the next paddle, the next stroke, right? And if I could figure out how to transfer that form of focus into writing, it would be really great. But I haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be really good. You mentioned that you have the sequel to Quarter Fives out in August. Is that right?
Yeah.
For listeners who may not have stumbled across Quarter Fives, which I don't understand how they couldn't have, because there were so many people raving about that book when it came out. But if people have been away on another planet and haven't heard about it, how would you describe this series to them so they can catch up before August, before book two comes out?
The need to use it like a Hollywood pitch to describe series of voice is like my bane, right? I'm working on it.
I hear you.
Quarter Fives is a young adult fantasy trilogy, which if you know my other books, in which I am known for writing multi-layered complex stories with very dense world building, which if it's in your wheelhouse, it's great. And if it's not in your wheelhouse, it's not so great. It's what I do. So this is kind of like the streamlined version of that. That's because the young adult thing, there's always pacing, and focus on one person's experience of it, the main character's experience of it. But I call this Little Women Meet America Ninja Warrior, or Sasuke, in a fantasy setting inspired by Greco-Roman Egypt.
Awesome. That is awesome. And you said you were no good at these pitches. That's great. Well,
I worked a long time to come up with
it. And there's a sequel you're working on to Black Wolves as well. Is that right?
Right. Black Wolves came out last November. It's the first volume of an epic fantasy trilogy, which I'm pretty sure will be just a trilogy. One of my readers said it was like Jane Austen's Persuasion meets Dragon Age, the video game.
Oh, wonderful.
I don't have a good pitch for it because it's very long and very complex, and I know exactly what I'm doing with it. And I'm just trying to put all my love of epic fantasy. I love epic fantasy, and all my criticism of the kind of tropes and histories that I find problematic. And I'm trying to kind of put them all in there and tell this big story that says, listen, there are other ways that we can tell epic fantasies that aren't just about, you know, dude fests, right?
Yep.
That we can foreground women, like a lot of women, and not just women who are in male roles, but show how women who are in traditionally female roles as well can be heroic, and how the things, the choices they make and the things they do can be super important in these kind of epic empire shaking ways, rather than only framing women as being able to be actors if they're acting like men. And I mean in traditionally male roles, mm-hmm. historically, which often weren't historically only men in them. I wrote a long article on Tor.com in March talking about how history, how when people say, well, women never did anything in the past, it's simply untrue.
Yeah.
The history is filled with examples of women doing things that we can use as templates. It's just, I just want to show women in a range of roles because I think that matters so much, to say that women's lives, no matter what they were in the past, by dismissing women's lives in the past, by not celebrating them, we do the same work as happens when people, you know, erase them or say that, well, yes, Queen Elizabeth is important, but not, you know, some woman brewing beer over here in, you know, in Nottingham or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So that's Black Wolves is filled with incident and politics and all that stuff.
Yay.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm working on book two on that. And I'm revising the third of the young adult trilogy right now.
Excellent. Something I'd like to ask you might sound a little bit strange because it's all to do with the chickens in the pen over there. What I'd like to do is to ask you if there was a theme tune to your life, what would it be? Because what I do is ask the chickens to sing it for us. They're very special chickens.
I went over and over this question in my head when you asked it in our exchange of letters flown by messenger pigeon earlier. And I realized that I had like 10 or 12 or 13 or 14 songs that were more wonderful to me and that each represent a different aspect of me. And then I decided that probably U2's I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For would be the best example. Because that was me, right? I still quite haven't found it.
And it's such an iconic song as well.
I love that song, actually.
Yeah.
Because that is me. I'm always curious and I'm always trying to learn more and I'm always, you know, looking. I'm always on that quest.
Okay, so Little Chickens, please could you sing I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For by U2?
Wow.
It's pretty unusual, isn't it? Do you need another cup of tea?
The chickens we had were not that talented.
They may be unique, I'm not sure, but they're certainly talented. I would agree with that. Oh, well, let me just check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty. There's nothing to be done except to make sure that you return home safely, especially now as we must have drifted some way into the Bermuda Triangle. So I think I want to make sure that we both get home safely. So that leaves me with just my gratitude and immense thanks for coming and taking tea with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This has been lovely and the water has been lovely.
Yes, isn't it so peaceful? It's lovely. And I'm so pleased that you're a fan of the ocean as well. I think it was a good location for us to take tea.
Absolutely.
So if you go around to the other side of the boat, the motorboat is attached around there, and Latimer will make sure that you're safely in it. And I will hopefully see you at a convention at some point in the future.
I hope so.
Take care now. Bye.
This way, Mum. Now I can finally complete my research on why things vanish within the Bermuda Triangle.
But Latimer, there's no such thing, really.
I think you'll find there is, Mum.
Oh, no. It's not you, is it, Latimer? You haven't been making ships and aircraft disappear, have you?
No, Mum. The cause is a portal between this world and its opposite, the anti-world.
The anti-world? Is that the one where raisins taste better than chocolate?
That's the one, Mum.
Oh, the one where Rupert Murdoch...
Look, Mum, there's one of the portals over there. As objects from our world approach, as Miss Elliot is at the moment, they draw the anti-version of themselves to them. And then, when the two halves meet, they explode, removing both from existence. And that is why so many ships and planes have vanished, never to return.
Ah, I understand. Oh no, wait a minute. I can see the Auntie Kate Elliot now. She has a goatee. It's just like that time in Knight Rider when his evil twin arrived.
I confess it's not the most original of dimensions.
So does the Auntie Adrian Tchaikovsky not have a beard then?
All Adrian Tchaikovskys have beards. It's one of the four prime laws of universal harmony.
Oh no, I've been distracted and Kate's about to meet her Auntie self.
What a terrible shame.
You all think you're so special, but you really aren't. And frankly, this tea isn't even any good.
Oh, Latimer, are you all right?
One can take an insult, Mum. Even a slur on one's silverware. But to attack the tea, it's too much.
Aw. Oh, look, she's dispatching her children.
Sacrificing her own children? Perhaps I underestimated her.
No, I mean she's sending them in. They're making sure that the two Kates don't touch.
Ugh! Are they having a group hug?
Oh, they are. How lovely.
Ugh!
They're not exploding at all. The anti-Kate seems to be fading away and merging with our Kate. Oh, I think it's all going to be okay. Doesn't the sky look a bit odd over there, Latimer? Oh, do you think another portal is opening for an anti-me and anti-you?
It's a distinct possibility, Mum.
Oh, then let's go. As much as I want to see what you look like with a goatee, we shouldn't take the risk.
Actually, Mum, I've met the anti-you. You wouldn't like her. She puts the clotted cream onto the scones before the jam.
What? Quick, get us out of here!
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.